Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Ask the experts about free fitting on all our kitchens. cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Now though, women and children were among those killed when an Israeli airstrike hit a building and tents in the Daraj region of Gaza City yesterday. The Hamas-run health ministry said 80 people were killed in total as the IDF continues its offensive in the city. Hundreds and thousands of people have left Gaza City, but many more remain as Israel continues to pummel the area. The aid situation in Gaza remains dire. The BBC has made a documentary about that deadly struggle to get food. The BBC's Jeremy Bowen joins us now. Good morning, Jeremy.
Morning.
You're the face of this documentary, but of course you can't get into Gaza to report the story at first hand. And that's a situation I know that the BBC and of course other news organisations have been trying to change for 2 years now. You, though, have been relying in this documentary for people, on people who are in Gaza in the main, to tell the story.
Yeah, it's really difficult to try and do one of these things because Israel, as a matter of policy, has restricted the free reporting of what's going on in Gaza. I think we can only conclude that's because they don't want it to be, they don't want full access to what they're up to, basically. They don't want people to see it. They don't want the resulting international outcry that's already existing getting hotter and harder. So anyway, we have to try and work around that. So I'll tell you how we did this one. We used a combination of things. First of all, we, through a production company in Gaza who we worked with before, we had filming done, you know, all directed by the producers on the in the BBC team. We did interviews. You know, again, we said this is what we want you to ask them. We also used this thing which has now become very commonplace, but still to me is kind of magical in a way, open source intelligence, which is another way of saying there's a massive amount of information out there that can corroborate things. So, you know, satellite pictures, using software to analyze the sound of bullets, and which can you learn about trajectory and stuff like that from there. We also spoke to whistleblowers who'd worked inside Gaza and left, foreigners who worked for this. One who'd worked for this Gaza Humanitarian Foundation and also a soldier from Israel's army, mm-hmm. the IDF. So, you know, various sources that we had to try and put together and verify and just check that they weren't pulling the wool over our eyes. And so, you know, it was a big team and it was a lot of work.
Now, you mentioned the whistleblower who was involved in the distribution of aid. This is a man who you're calling John in this piece. What did he tell you about how that system works or doesn't?
Well, I think he said it was chaotic, that there was always gunfire at these sites. The Gaza Humanitarian Foundation itself and its lawyers say that they're not aware, or they deny, in fact, that anyone has been killed at or near, or that there's been considerable shooting. And the evidence absolutely points to something very different to that. And he was so shocked by what he saw that he filmed it secretly. They weren't meant to be filming. And he gave us those videos, which we were able to corroborate and verify and relate to other videos of from the same site and build a story that way. But essentially, he said that this is, I mean, for me, one of the key things he said was, I said, do you feel like you're a part of a humanitarian operation? Because, of course, the criticism by the United Nations and others of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation, which was set up by Israel and the US to try and basically supersede the UN system. I said, did you feel like you were part of a humanitarian operation? The UN says it's not at all humanitarian. And he said, no, I felt like I was in a frontline military position. Mm. And, you know, this is not a place for vulnerable people to come and try and get aid. Clearly, that's the point the UN makes. And I think one thing our film succeeded in doing was prove how lethal a process that is, which is why we called the film Dying for Food.
And you have the story of one young man, a 19-year-old, and I found it really upsetting to hear about the footage from his bedroom where he had post-its over his desk.
It was so upsetting. I find it upsetting even to think about it. Mm. It was so sad, you know, his father in there looking, you know, talking about his son's dreams and saying, my son didn't fulfill one of his dreams. He had so many, he didn't fulfill any dreams. And he said his son had insisted on going down there and he didn't want him to go, but, you know, we needed the food. The vast majority of the people who turn up at these sites are young men because it's a free-for-all. It's hard to get there. It's hard to get the aid. They've sometimes got to fight each other for it because that desperate. And one thing, and they make up the bulk of the dead. One thing the IDF whistleblower we spoke to said was, I could not believe that we brought these people to this point where they were in such a frenzy for food. I think what he was saying was that how Israel has degraded them, and it wasn't, in his opinion, necessary.
Mm-hmm. This 19-year-old man who was killed, there's an interview in the piece with a friend who was with him. They went together in the very early morning to one of the aid points. Will you explain to us what the witness said happened to Abdullah?
Yeah, the witness is his friend, childhood friend, who's called Muaz. He went with him, and he said they were waiting. They had gone down the route. The IDF soldiers said, go that way. So they went that way and they were waiting. And then it was sort of, the thing hadn't opened yet. It was around dawn. It'd been a long old journey. And Abdullah had a call of nature. You know, he wanted, so he moved away from them to get a bit of privacy. And apparently, according to Muaz, that's when he was shot. And then Muaz said that he dashed over to him and there was a lot of shooting going on. He said it was heavy fire, but I got to him. And he said he was with him for 10 minutes and then he died. Muaz said, we asked people to help us carry him, but everyone was desperately, by that stage, the site had opened, people were desperately trying to get food. Eventually they found a donkey cart. And because so many people these days film on their videos, we actually found a video of Muaz and a couple of other young guys pushing the body of Abdullah, helping out the donkey, you know, as they were trying to get to the hospital. I think, you know, there's always a hope that somehow there could be a miracle or... And anyway, yeah, so we had video not just of the donkey cart, but also the arrival at hospital and Abdullah being put into a body bag.
Mm-hmm. And then that interview with the parents and the notes over his desk saying you must get over 95% in your exams. And as his poor bereft dad said, he didn't get to fulfill any of his dreams.
It's so sad. It's so sad. And that is multiplied by thousands. I mean, that's the whole point about this. Mm-hmm. That is multiplied by thousands. That was one case.
There's a mother in there as well, Reem, who's trying to get food for her children. Mm. And the team hasn't been able to contact Reem recently. Now, I know there's maybe a theory that she has been displaced yet again.
Yeah, that seems to be, I mean, that's the likelihood, and hopefully she's okay. Reem was looking, her two kids, her husband was, who was a civilian, was out looking for food early in the war. At that point, there were still shops operating, but, you know, going outside was a dangerous business, and he got killed in one of the Israeli raids. She spoke to us. She was like, if you like, every woman, you know, someone who desperately trying to get food for her kids. And we filmed her doing a little bit of cooking. She said mostly she'd get a bit of bread, maybe some flour to make a bit of bread if she was lucky. They might get some lentils. They might have some handouts of some tins. But it was always a struggle. And you could see that, you know, her child was ill. He had, but her son, who's 10, had tonsillitis, and it doesn't sound like much, though it's pretty unpleasant, even in, you know, in the UK or in Ireland, for a kid to get nasty bout of tonsillitis. But if you're already weakened, these childhood bugs get much worse. I do need to say, in the interests of impartiality, that the Israeli Defense Forces, we asked them for an interview. We asked the Israeli ambassador in London for an interview. Neither would give us an interview. The embassy passed us on to the army. The army gave us some written answers. They said things like the IDF does not deliberately target innocent civilians, was how they put it, which I thought was an interesting choice of words. How do you define deliberately and innocent? And the UG Solutions, who are the security contractor for the We also asked for an interview with them. They didn't give us an interview either. We also asked UG Solutions and GHF if we could visit one of their sites. And that was also turned down. So it's not a great deal of openness going on there, but we did our best. And, we put forward their point of view as well, which is UG Solutions says that people do not open fire. They don't kill people. Mm-hmm. There's evidence that is not the case.
Well, you had that conversation with Michael, who's a soldier or was a soldier. He's a whistleblower in this piece. And he explained to you about the red and green system the IDF has when it comes to firing. So how did that work?
It's essentially using, and the thing that really concerned him was why he wanted to talk to us. And he came to us through an organization called Breaking the Silence, which is an organization of Israeli army veterans who talk about the realities of being a soldier in the occupation, and they are an organization which is against the occupation of Palestinian territory. So he said that they were ordered to say there are two imaginary lines, and one's a red imaginary line and one's a green imaginary line. And they were told where these imaginary lines are by their commanders. And they were told that if the first line, I think it was probably the green line, was passed, then you had to open fire next to the crowd to push them back and to show them that they're in a no-go place.
This is a crowd queuing for food at the humanitarian organization.
Potentially several thousand desperate people pushing ahead because, it's a competition. It's like the bit in the beginning of the Hunger Games where, they have to raid the cornucopia to try and get it, and there isn't enough for everybody. So if they cross the first imaginary line, they fire warning shots, and there's loads of video of machine gun bullets kicking up the sand just feet away from these crowds. And if they cross the second imaginary line, the orders are use lethal force. You shoot them. He said his unit had an officer who did not want them to do that, so it didn't happen. So he said that was really by luck. And he said the whole thing, this is a quote from him more or less, was he said it was so chaotic. He started thinking maybe it's meant to be this chaotic. I said, what do you mean by that? And he said that it's meant to fail. He said, well, it's because the government, Netanyahu, has said in his he said in Hebrew, we'll allow in only minimal amounts of aid. In English, he said, we'll allow in adequate aid. And his hardliners in the cabinet, these extremists, don't want any aid in there at all. And Israel stopped all aid for earlier on this year for a couple of months, which caused massive damage in the hunger stakes. And Michael theorized that perhaps that they basically didn't want the whole thing to work. They were prepared to do it for the, to answer the concerns abroad and particularly in the US about hunger, but they didn't actually want it to work. I've got no proof of that. Mm-hmm. Interesting, though, that one of the soldiers who was actually stationed just next to the site came to that conclusion.
And again, we should say, and you've said this very clearly, that you put this to the IDF and to the Israelis, and they deny that this is happening, and they deny that they're deliberately shooting civilians.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation says we have delivered millions of meals. The thing is, it's dry food. You've got to cook it. A lot of people don't have cooking facilities or even water to cook with. Mm. So how do you cook a bag of lentils if you don't have cooking facilities? So the way the UN used to do it, a lot of it went to communal kitchens where, you've seen all these pictures of desperate people lining up for tureen, with lentil soup and stuff like that. So that was made, they would use the aid to make things for people who didn't have kitchens, which is, if you consider that almost all of the 2 million plus people in Gaza have been displaced multiple times. Every time in these humanitarian emergencies, I was a reporter, I've been to very many over many years. Every time a family gets displaced, they lose more things, they leave more things behind.
Of course.
By the time they've been displaced three or four times, normally they've just got what they can put in a tiny backpack.
On the wider issue of, moves to end this or to have a ceasefire, I mean, we know that Donald Trump has absolutely rejected the recognition of Palestine as a state in his UN speech this week. Efforts by Qatar and other Arab nations to negotiate a ceasefire seem to have completely derailed. Where are we at now, in your assessment?
Well, there is talking going on. The Steve Witkoff, Trump's envoy, is talking a bit to the I think the Egyptians and the Qataris. But, you know, it was only about 10 days ago that the Israelis tried to kill the Hamas negotiating team by bombing their premises in Doha, in the capital of Qatar. So that wasn't a sign of sincerity in negotiations, I think the Qataris would say. The fact they used much stronger language when they spoke at the United Nations this week. So I don't think that's really going anywhere at the moment. The chances of a ceasefire are very, very minimal. Trump is said to want one. He's meeting Netanyahu, I think, on Monday, because Netanyahu's going to New York at the moment, I think, for to make a speech tomorrow at the UN. But before he left, when he was condemning the idea of recognizing Palestine, saying it was a reward for terrorism, he said, "I'll tell you what we're going to do in retaliation for that, as it were, when I get back." In other words, if he wants to annex land as a reprisal, then he wants to get Trump's say-so. Mm-hmm. Trump yesterday had a meeting with Arab leaders at the UN, and they talked about an American proposal, which is actually very like Arab proposals that were put forward months ago, and many thousands of casualties and dead people, you know, have been happened since then. Reportedly, the Arab leaders said, "Yeah, it's a good plan, we'll take it, but you must not let Israel annex any land, and you must insist on the immediate opening of the gates to unfettered aid." So will the Israelis do that? Well, we'll see. There are lots of big questions the next few days.
Well, the documentary is called Dying for Food. The BBC has made it available for people to see on YouTube, I understand, outside of the UK, which is very useful.
It's on YouTube
for us here. So Dying for Food, if people want to have a look. Jeremy, thank you very much for telling us about it.
It's a great pleasure. Thanks for giving me the time.
Not at all. Delighted to have you with us. Jeremy Bowen there from the BBC.
Get in touch on WhatsApp 0870 32 32 32.